Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Hi, everybody, and thank you all very much for the invitation and for coming. This paper, I think this panel is really integrating very well, and it's really the case that my talk is going to be picking up exactly where Barry's left off, although I'm sure, or I suspect strongly, that I'll be making an argument probably that Barry wouldn't. I don't have PowerPoints or handouts or anything like that. I just talk. And the other sort of caveat is that this is a work in progress, and what I like to do with works in progress is sort of exaggerate a bit rhetorically to get responses so that by the time I actually write the thing, they'll be more tempered, so bear with me. The paper is divided, or the talk is divided into two parts. The first one is destructive. I'm going to argue that if impunity, which is to say the absence of criminal punishment, is if the battle against impunity is the chief aim of international criminal justice, then international criminal justice is in a lot of trouble. And I'll explain why I think that is. So that's the first destructive part of the talk. And in the second, what I hope is constructive part of the talk, I will try to reinterpret what I think is the best reading of what the struggle against impunity is actually struggling against, in order to suggest that the foundations or the justifying aim of international criminal justice is actually a far more broad and a far more social one than the narrow conception of denying impunity to individual perpetrators. The problem with that construction, that constructive proposal, is that to the degree that it is constructive, it may work against the very idea of individualized crime, the very foundation on which international criminal law rests. So it might be a dubious win if I do, in fact, succeed in resetting the foundations of ICL. So first of all, let me just start by reminding you of something you already know, which is the extraordinary hegemony of the anti-impunity norm as a general justifying aim for international criminal law. By hegemony, I mean something pretty specific here, not necessarily the Gramscian sense. What I mean is that if you look at the mission statements of international courts, including the ICC, if you look at the mission statements of international criminal tribunals, and increasingly over the last 15 years, if you look at the mission statements of the major, the most influential, well-funded, and powerful international human rights NGOs, you see a version of what Christopher, in his paper, talked about earlier as a version of Catherine Sikking's conception of a justice cascade. Cascade is a very nice word. It evokes lovely images. One could also think of a cascade as a flood or an inundation. And again, to rhetorically exaggerate to make my point, one could say that over the past 15 years or so, the norm of denying impunity to individual perpetrators has cascaded to such an extent that it has not only become hegemonic as the general justifying norm of international criminal law, but it has risen over the banks of ICL and has flooded neighboring areas of international law, including international human rights law and international humanitarian law. This hegemonic presence of the anti-impunity norm has resulted in what I would call a certain kind of reification, which is to say, we now commonly think of closing the impunity gap, battling against impunity, denying a culture of impunity, as referring to a thing, a real event, a phenomenon in the world called impunity, against which we have to muster all of our legal and political tools. So that rather than taking impunity as a measure or a diagnosis or a proxy of deeper political and social problems, in the rhetoric of international criminal law, it's now not at all uncommon to see impunity as the cause of social ills. So that if we can only address and close the impunity gap, then the goals of international criminal law will be met. Now, this all may be fine. The destructive part of the paper now, which I'm doing, basically takes the view that if we interpret impunity in the narrow sense, in the strict or narrow sense in which I think it is generally interpreted, impunity means the absence or lack of the imposition of due legal sanction or punishment. And therefore, following right from Berry's paper, punishment becomes the general justifying aim of international criminal law. Now, a point that Berry made toward the end of his paper, and I think that the person you were probably thinking of is Luban, is that one of the disanalogies, I think, between the domestic context and the international legal context is that whether we're talking about expressive justifications or any other kinds of justifications, much of the significance of international criminal law, it seems to me anyway, is upstream, and in fact far upstream, from the imposition of criminal legal sanctions. And therefore, both the hegemonic and the reified status of the impunity norm risks undermining and occluding what seem to me to be the plausible ends of international criminal law. And by plausible here, I mean, among other things, those ends that seem to be worth continued funding of lots and lots and lots of money by various national and international actors. Now, Berry has already given you a sort of a very clear and lucid thumbnail description of the three flavors of a justification for individual punishment that are in the literature. And without going through them all again, I can certainly say something that I think that Berry probably wouldn't say, which is something like this. I'm going to cut to the chase here because I want to leave plenty of time. I am certainly not convinced that the predominant contemporary strategy for justifying in ICL punishment, expressivism, succeeds. I just don't buy it, I don't buy it for a couple of different reasons, which I'll go through very quickly in order to get to the second constructive part of the paper. One of the reasons why expressivism doesn't convince me as a justification for punishment is common to both the international and the domestic context. And it's this. If you look at the whole sweep of literature on expressivism from the early days of Feinberg all the way through somebody like Anthony Duff, there is a premise that is suppressed in the argument for expressivism. And the premise may not be true. The premise is this. Of all the means available to a society to express sufficient moral condemnation of especially heinous acts, punishment is by far the best. Now, that may be true. I kind of doubt it is, but it may be. But there's never any argument for it. So it is usually taken on faith that punishment is the least worst or possibly the best overall option. Thought experiment, right? Suppose in a post-conflict recovering society you have the president for life who has been deposed from power, has been brought to justice, and has been convicted of a certain number of crimes against humanity by a domestic court with jurisdiction. And now the chancellor of the exchequer, the minister of finance, says to the prosecutor, okay, you've got two choices. We have we have 10 million somethings, 10 million rupees or euros or dollars or whatever. You have two choices on how to spend them. One, this would support this president for life in prison for the rest of his natural life. Two, we can have a big national event, which would bring in pop stars and fireworks and parades, all of which is the national day of condemnation of the terrible acts of the former deposed president. Which communicates, which expresses better? I'm not entirely sure, or actually I am. Again, to skip a part of my paper forward, here I'll come to the end of my destructive part with what is a deliberately provocative thesis. I think that of all the defenses of individual punishment available to us, really retributivism is all we've got. I don't think deterrence works for a lot of reasons that we can go into. I don't think expressivism is a particularly philosophically compelling theory. What I do think is that the versions of expressivism that are most plausible, namely Hampton's, are plausible because they're expressive of retributivism, right? The problem with retributivism, however, is what one might call the Kantian ick factor. The Kantian ick factor is nobody really wants to be a retributivist. By Kantian here, I mean the famous passage in Kant's Metaphysics of Morals, where he says that retributivism is simply the moral obligation to give the criminal his due, even if the world should perish. And his famous example is that if there's one murderer left in a dark prison cell on a desert island that the entire society is evacuating, then the last thing they do, even after turning out the lights and putting the keys under the mat, should be to go down to the prison cell and execute him. That vision of retributivism, of hard Kantian retributivism, is extremely unattractive. It evokes negative intuitive responses. And yet, it seems to me that in the prosecutorial culture of international criminal law, that kind of retributivism actually underwrites a lot of the anti-impunity norm, notwithstanding the appeals to other kinds of consequentialist justifications. So the claim that I end the first destructive part of the paper with would read something like this. Retributivism, as far as the impunity norm goes, retributivism is the best that we've got, and it's probably not good enough. Okay, so let me try now in the constructive part of the paper to try another little thought experiment with you. Bear with me. What I'm going to try to do is to suggest that there's a lot more to retributivism than the Kantian version, right? I'm going to suggest that a version of retributivism expanded as far as I can possibly expand it with the idea of retribution making sense is a far better justification for international criminal law than the impunity norm contains. And I'm going to do that first of all by suggesting that the narrow reading of impunity as a retributive norm has often been, but should no longer be, conflated with a different kind of related norm, which is the norm of accountability. I think that in the language of the courts and in the language of the UN and in the language of the NGOs, you will often see an indifferent or undifferentiated use of impunity and the lack of accountability, right? And that the goal of justice is to bring accountability / impunity to societies and to perpetrators. I'd like to challenge this and say that impunity is merely one particular form that a much broader accountability norm can take. And now, because this is what we philosophers do, I'd like to make a further distinction. I would like to make a distinction amongst two different kinds of accountability. This is actually something I'm stealing from Robert Keohane. Two different kinds of accountability. Let's call the first one consequence accountability. Consequence accountability can be defined as liability to a negative consequence as a foreseeable or intended result of a prescribed action. Right? If you do something bad, then something bad will happen to you. You'll be fined, penalized, your girlfriend, boyfriend will break up with you, you'll be fired from your job. Whatever that is, consequence accountability is the association of a foreseeable or intended negative consequence to a prescribed action. Impunity is one legal variant of consequence accountability. There is another meaning or sense of accountability here that I'd like to suggest, which I'm going to call process accountability, as opposed to consequence accountability. And by process accountability, I'm going to say it consists in of being under an obligation to present reasons to an appropriate agent as the result of a disputed action. One is process accountable if one is under an obligation to present reasons to give an account to an appropriate agent as a result of a disputed action. Now, I think that you can see, if you accept that distinction, that criminal legal procedures have both process and consequence accountability moments. The process accountability moment has to do with the trial. The consequence accountability moment has to do with the punishment. You see where I'm going? I'm trying to move this idea of impunity back upstream from the consequence accountability model, where it seems to me to be stuck, more upstream to the process accountability model. And I'm going to try to say that actually an expanded version of retributivism applies just as well, if not better, to process than it does to consequence. All right. On these, the theme of the second part is trying to move ICL's general justifying aim from impunity to accountability. Right. I'm going to skip. How much time do I have? 10 more minutes. Oh, okay. Maybe I won't skip. Okay. I thought I had, what's that?
Probably five.
Okay. All right. 8? 7.5. Okay. What do I mean by this? What I mean is that retributivism certainly does have a core meaning, or one core meaning, in the concept of desert. Right. One is retributive when one gives somebody what they deserve by the imposition of hard treatment. Right. There are lots of other ways to formulate the idea of retributivism, however, in terms of things like fairness retributivism or promised retributivism, or there's a whole literature on this. And I'm going to suggest that for international criminal law, in rather a disanalogy from the domestic case, from the domestic parallel, that retributivism, in the broadest possible sense, really only need to refer to the situation in which a legal authority or a court with jurisdiction recognizes that it is under an obligation, that it has a duty to impose criminal procedures or criminal attention on an individual person, which criminal attention would result in the imposition of punishment following a conviction. Right? So the imposition of legal treatment is not punishment. It's not hard treatment in the technical sense, to be arrested and to be made to sit in jail awaiting trial and to be made to give your reasons, right? However, it is giving the person what he is due, and giving the person what he is due because you have an obligation to do so is, in this expanded sense I'm trying to use, also a form of retribution. So I think what I'm trying to do here, and you might come with me, you might not, is I'm trying to get some daylight between the concept of retribution in the broadest moral legal sense and the narrow sense of the imposition of the criminal sanction. I think there's more to retribution than that. Retribution is not about punishment being good. Retribution is about the idea of legal attention, including punishment, being the result of an obligation that one has. Sorry, that's my timer. I'll stop. I'll tap to stop. Why won't it stop? Sorry. Thank you. I'm out of time. I've taken too long. But in the last few moments of the paper, what I'm going to suggest, and I'll just throw this out there for your interest, is that if you follow me with this conception of an expanded notion of retribution, then it is both the accused who is process liable in the legal procedure, because he, and I use this gendered term deliberately, because he is under an obligation to give an account of himself. He has to give reasons. It's not just a forensic process in order to establish empirical truth. It is a process of self-justification, right? It is a public moment in which the accused is required, not just invited, to give a public account of himself. But the court must be accountable too. The court and the accused, or the legal power and the accused, have in the legal criminal procedure a moment of reciprocity in procedural or process accountability that vanishes at the moment of consequence accountability. It's that moment of reciprocity where the court owes reasons not just to the accused, but to a broader audience that interests me the most. And had I, were I to have another half hour, what I would say is there is, in other words, a certain possibility of what I would call a cosmopolitan retributivism at work here, which is to say, what distinguishes international criminal procedures, I think, from the domestic analogy most clearly in my mind, is that the retributive obligations that the court possesses are obligations regarding the due treatment, the due legal attention to a certain small class of international offenders, that the court recognizes it must justify to an international community. That can be, that accountability, that giving of reasons, can take the very formal, technical form of the court's assertion of proper jurisdiction. Or, and I think this is really where I'm going with this project, or the court, whether it's a domestic court or an international court or an ad hoc tribunal or a special jurisdiction, the court can and should also discharge its own process accountability toward the international community in terms of much less formal nimbus or cloud of deliberative possibilities that surround and make possible the actual criminal procedure itself. This is the way that I would read, and I'm thinking of some of Morton's work here, this is how I would read, make the final claim of this paper, which is that cosmopolitan retributivism is best cashed out in the process of a positive or active complementarity. In other words, farther upstream even than the criminal procedure itself, in terms of a court in withstanding, giving an account of itself to an international community that can't sanction it, but to whom it owes justifying reasons about whom to prosecute, what charges to bring, and crucially, what will count as an adequate or proportionate form of criminal sanction. So I'm going to stop there, although, again, if I had yet another hour, I would say that, and this is the other half of the project that is not going to be in this chapter, my favorite example right now of cosmopolitan retributivism as positive complementarity has to do with the process that led to the formation of the Special Jurisdiction for Peace in Colombia, which I think is a very nice example of exactly the sort of process that I have in mind. Okay, thanks for your patience very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.